Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good afternoon. We are going to continue in our journey of Acts chapter 17 through chapter 18. I actually have 17 pages of notes on this. It is unbelievably dense, but we aren't going to have to go through all those. And well, you never know. You never know. We're gonna keep it to our typical time, around an hour ish, or 40 minutes. Either one. We'll just kind of see how it goes. Anyways, so where we are and where we were and where we're going is Paul, Silas, and the rest of the troop have been turning the world upside down as they've traveled through Philippi and Thessalonica. Though many people have converted along this time, they've converted to the way or the new Christian belief or to the following the Jewish Messiah. There are just as many who have become very upset with Paul and Silas and everything they're doing. And so these traveling vagabonds, as they're referred to, are bringing the good news, which on the surface to many is not good news. And we saw that last week, and we'll continue to see that here in Beroea, depending on, I don't know, I've had a couple challenges with that one. We'll see how it goes as they run through there, and eventually we'll end up in Corinth before we're done for the day, or maybe not. Well, it depends on, again, how far we can get. So we will begin here in chapter 17, verse 10, where the brethren immediately send Paul and Silas away. So Paul is sent off to Berea by the brothers and sisters of the Thessalonian church, and he eventually makes his way to Athens after being kicked out of Berea because the influence of the Thessalonian Jews in Berea. So the Thessalonians have followed Paul to Berea, and again, it really depends on what translation you have. It could be Beroea, or it could be Berea, so, you know, again, depending on what translation you're looking at. Anyways, the Thessalonians had followed him, those who had already kind of upset with him and followed him to Berea and caused some problems with the prominent women and the men of that community. So before we get rolling here, before we talk much more about that, let's talk about, let's go over verses 10 through 15 and of his time in Berea, and then we'll go to Athens. And then we'll have that sermon over there on Mars Hill. And then we'll eventually end up in Corinth as we go through this journey of Paul, or with Paul. The brethren, for those of you who are following along and like to know how tenses and the grammar works throughout this, as well as who exactly we're referring to, brethren here is actually the brothers and sisters, immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, they went into the synagogue of the Jews. Now these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica, for they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Therefore, many of them believed, along with a number of prominent Greek women and men. But when the Jews of Thessalonica found out that the word of God had been proclaimed by Paul and Berea, also they came there as well, agitating and stirring up the crowds. Then immediately the brethren sent Paul to go as far as the sea, and Silas and Timothy remained there. Now those who escorted Paul brought him as far as Athens, and receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible, they left. There's a lot of things going on here, of course, Paul doing a lot of traveling, but the time frames and stuff that we go through here sometimes looks like it's a couple weeks, sometimes it looks like it's immediate, a couple days. We'll hit on a little bit of that. But before we do, let's talk a little bit more about this. The trip to Berea takes Paul west, deeper into Macedonia. He will then head south on the Aegean Sea to Athens. We'll get there in a second. Okay, a significant land and sea voyage, as you can imagine, as you were going through this. Interestingly enough, this takes him further from Rome rather than closer to Rome. As we have gone on this journey with Paul, we've seen how his response to the Jews and God-fearers is different from what he says to the Greeks in Macedonia. He is able, and he does change his teaching methods and what he teaches and what he references depending on who his audience is, which of course all good teachers are able to do. And if he were to go into some of these places and speak of a lot of stuff out of the Old Testament, they would have no idea what he was referring to, and their context and point of reference would be helpless against what he was trying to explain, and he would not get much traction that way. So it's going to be a completely different conversation once he makes his way to Athens. And then it'll be different again when he gets into Corinth, just a little bit. There seems to be a large Jewish population in Corinth, unlike in Athens. Anyways, why would Paul go off the main road of the Via Ignatia? So the Via Ignatia would be was the road that he was on as he was traveling from Thessalonica to Berea along that way. It was a major road, major thoroughfare. And what it would do is eventually take him to the coast, then he could jump on a boat and jump over into Rome. But he doesn't do that. And it seems that the Thessalonians probably thought that the people who were chasing, for the most part, probably thought it was a good idea not to, because the Thessalonian brothers were probably like, hey, you know what? Let's take him off the beaten path and let's figure out how to keep these people who are following him to get off his path. And so they take him to or send him off to Berea. They put him on a boat south to ancient capital of Greece, eventually to the ancient capital of Greece. It was not clear, and likely it was not, that Paul wanted to even go to Athens. In Philippi, like we said, he was on the Via Ignatia, which leads to Rome. You go through Thessalonica across northern Greece and take a boat across the straits to Brindisi, which is on the southeast coast or the heel of Italy, for those of you who've been there, and from there to Rome, and that would be the logical path. However, just like in other times, the Holy Spirit has different plans for Paul, and so he takes this other direction. Berea, according to the historian Cicero, is an out-of-the-way town. It wasn't much of a town. It was about 40 miles west-southwest of Thessalonica, so it kind of took him off the path or the scent of those who were trying to chase him down and continue to chase him away. It does have a little notoriety, and what that is it was the first city to surrender to the Romans at the end of the Third Macedonian War. So that's pretty exciting if you like to keep up with that sort of history. Now, as we look into his time in Berea before we head over to Athens, we can relish in the scene that Paul is at first welcomed into Berea, and people are accepting and embracing this new idea, that their new faith that he has brought to them or allowed them to learn about. So many women and men of high standing come to the faith and about hearing the good news. And there's some fun history about this related to the people in the future would refer to themselves as Bereans. People in the future, as in later in the century and then following centuries, would refer to themselves as Bereans. And it's based on the amount of Bible study and the intense level of Bible study that the Jewish Bereans did as a church. So they were all in, those Jews who did accept what Paul was teaching there in Berea. They were all for it, and people knew that. They were excited about that opportunity. We'll learn more about one of these noble Bereans later on in chapter 20 when we meet Pyrrhus. As we look into verse 13, unfortunately, their evil is still lurking in the shadows, and the Jews from Thessalonica, like I said, pick up the scent of where Paul is and come down to harass Paul there. And as we look into verses 14 and 15, this time, notice that it's just Paul who is sent off as we look into this. Silas remains, and so does Timothy. He is put on a boat and sent to the intellectual capital of the ancient world, known as Athens, and for now he is on his own. Now, there are some people who say he could have, or the way, especially if you look at the way the King James is written, in order to throw the Jews off the track of Paul, they pretended they put him on a boat. Instead, they did a land journey down to Athens, which you could have done. But this is more obvious if you were to read through, say, the King James version of this version. Now, either way, he makes it to Athens, be it land or be it by sea, and then eventually sends for Silas and Timothy to come enjoy him. So his time in Berea was bittersweet. It grew, it looked like, into a decent, strong church, but there are also a lot of people who were against what Paul was teaching as well. All right, Paul heads off to Athens, or now he is in Athens. And so let's look and see what that is. We'll read from 16 to verse 21 here. Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, waiting for Silas and Timothy, his spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols. That's what I like about Paul. He is not a guy to sit around and wait for his friends to show up. He is already having the desire to do what he has been called to do, and so he is doing it. So he's reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles and in the marketplace every day with those who happen to be present. And also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, "What would this idle babbler wish to say?" That is actually not a nice thing, is what they're saying. Others, "He seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is which you are proclaiming?" They're not really curious or looking to make fun of him, is the feeling I get. Now, there are some who are taking him serious as a philosopher, but these people were pretty arrogant related to their philosophy, and you have this new guy showing up. They're not super excited about it, and so it's a little bit of mocking going on here. "For you're bringing some strange things to our ears, so we want to know what these things mean. Now, all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new." That's significant. We don't always talk about that. We'll talk about it here in a second. So Luke is now telling us of Paul's time in Athens and how he is about to go head first into a very significant debate with the great philosophers of the time, which Athens housed many of them. Paul sees all the idols in Athens. Athens was very well known for its idols and temples to gods and other pagan cults, and so was something that you, and they were beautiful too. It wasn't just clay stacks of bricks. It was very beautiful and ornate temples and idols that were built. So it was very, very beautiful to the eye. He sees that their idols, of course, are a bit misleading. He notes the intellectual hierarchy and cultural novelties that are around. Like I said, there's a lot of them. This seems, of course, to be very disconcerting to Paul as we see his reaction here. Knowing a little bit about Athens during that time, the idea or concept of Jewish idol worship takes front stage. Paul's very, very aware that Jews are not to worship idols, and no one is actually to do that, but he, coming from the Jewish faith, is very familiar with that. But many of those, of course, in the Athenian faith, or not the Athenian faith, but those, many of those who are Greeks, did not see it that way and thought it was just part of how you worshiped. And so we see, and so what Paul is living through as he sees this is why it was such a big deal not to worship idols. And he is seeing the fruit of what happens when you worship idols, and it's not pretty. At this time, Athens, which was once a very strong political city, has lost its political stature, but was still extremely high in its level of culture and philosophy and arts during this time period. The sculpture and literature and oratory of that time period has never been surpassed, and it, of course, is continued to talk about today. If you look at the great books and as you look at a lot of the history of that time, it still influences many people to this day, in societies to this day. Philosophy at that point was also the highest level, at its highest level, with it being the home, of course, of Socrates and Plato, and the adopted home of Aristotle, Epicurus, and Zeno, all eventually making their homes there, or were part of that, the Athens community at some point in their lives. It was also known as the cradle of democracy, so if you're someone who's into government studies, or the politics, or even government affairs, you probably have studied some level of Athens' influence on democracy. Rome was so impressed with Athens that it, for the most part, allowed it to maintain its institutions and freedom within the Roman Empire. So it was actually autonomous, not necessarily autonomous, it's probably not the right word, but it was free to do a lot of the things that it wanted to do as a city, and Rome, for the most part, kept its hands off, of course, unless they got out of hand. It got a little bit rebellious, or probably didn't pay their taxes. We see the statues and buildings as works of art, but in the first century, today we see them as works of art. But in the first century, they truly were works of art because it took a lot of imagination, a lot of creativity, and a lot of skill to do to build them. But they were more than that. During the first century, the time that Paul is there, and of course time before that and even after, there were temples and images to pagan divinities, which is understandable about how Paul is reacting to this, but also some of the other influences that he's seen along the way. Paul was very familiar with the pagan rituals and divinities that these people worshipped as he walked through the streets of Athens. And of course, he was bothered by that. One thing he very much saw, of course, that goes against Old Testament teachings, and something that was very much highlighted as Old Testament teachings, and something that, of course, Jesus brought up and Paul will bring up again in his letters, especially when you talk about Ephesus, is the level of sexual morality and how idol worship was hand in hand with sexual morality and immorality, not morality. And it was, if we were to look at, say, go back and look at the art of that time, we'd see that the vase painting, statues, and related cult objects, it all kind of leaves very little to the imagination. They were very descriptive in how they created, painted, and did things. So, and it's very much sexualized, over-sexualized objectification of people. I'm glad that doesn't happen anymore. So for the most part, the human body had become a, as many commentators I've read said, a toy, objectified, both male and female. It wasn't just female bodies, it's male and female bodies, and were in full view of the people of Athens. It was an everyday thing for them to see that. And of course, for Paul, coming from a conservative Jewish background, also understanding the Torah and the significance of the human and how, as part of God's creation, saw that as a big deal and something that they would have to work through, and something, as we know, that he talked to many of his churches about, or wrote to many of his churches about. verses 17 and 18, he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. So there were some, of course, there would be synagogues because, of course, there were Jews in Athens. So he was there working with them. But what was said in the synagogues or in Lystra cannot be said here in the same way. We're dealing with the new young faith of Paul going against an ancient philosophical traditions of the time that were shaping, for the most part, the Western world. And beyond the synagogues, and that was, of course, where Paul always started, Paul had a lot of other places to go, and he went to the marketplace, which in Athens was a marketplace of not only just buying things, but it was also a marketplace of ideas where decisions were made and deals were made and policy was made. There he would be amongst the great philosophers of the time, the great philosophical schools of the time, and two of them that were very prominent during the time were the Stoics and the Epicureans. And both Stoics and Epicureans, at least their ideas and way of thinking, is still very prominent today. And we may not know it within our society, but if you were to read what an Epicurean is and what a Stoic is and what their ideas are, you'd see that especially when it comes to Stoicism, the idea of what Stoics believe, you'd see a lot of that even here in the United States. You'd see a lot of Epicurean ideas too. You actually see stores named Epicurean because, of course, it's about the excellent and great foods that are made for humans to enjoy, because that is what we're to do, is to enjoy everything about what we do. But just to give you a little bit of history here, the Epicureans were founded by Epicurus, and he was a member of the Athenian settlers on Samos. For the most part, it based its ethical, because you guys want to know this, ethical theory on the atomic physics of Democritus, and idea being that the chief goal of a human is pleasure. That's the chief goal of life, is to get as much pleasure as possible in life. And but what's important here is their thought that their gods were far away with little communication. My understanding is they believe that the world was created in some way by the gods, but the gods have now stepped away and looked at humans as probably annoying more than anything. And so they had walked away, and so the gods, because they believed in multiple gods, did not really have anything to do with the humans. And so because of that, one should just live their life however they would like, and without any sort of pain, with tranquility, but without any sort of disturbing passions or superstitious fears. They, for the most part, wanted to figure out how to get the maximum amount of pleasure from a quiet and sedate existence. And that sounds very similar to a lot of what we try to do today within our society. Like I said, they did not deny the existence of gods, but believed the gods could care less about the humans. And so kind of lived in that way, really kind of focused on their own pleasure and own understanding of what it is to get everything they possibly could that's pleasurable for them in life. There's so much more books upon books have been written about the Epicureans and especially its influence upon today, but that's just a very quick summary. The Stoics on the other side claimed the Cyprus native Zeno as their founder and referred to Stoics because for the most part they met in the Stoapoikile, which means a painted colonnade, so it was an area in which they met there in Athens. They lived with the idea of rational faculty, of humanity, and of self-sufficiency. So as you can see, that's something that's very much an American principle of self-sufficiency. They believed that the gods were within the present world and within each human, referred to by some as pantheistic, where God is the world or the soul. So they did believe in a divine source that was within them or within the world, though not in a personal way. So it was kind of for them, it was more about virtue and consisted of them getting in touch with and living according to an inner divine rationality. I would say it was probably marked by great moral inner earnestness and a high sense of duty. Again, you dig a little bit deeper and dig and just reflect on some American values. You see a lot of Stoic as well as Epicurean influences within a lot of stuff of that, of how we live on our day-to-day lives. So we get just a quick and brief summary of what the Stoics and the Epicureans were like. Though they were very different, they both agreed that the Jewish religion would not work on reasonable people. It just doesn't seem to work within their worldview and context. So for the most part, they kind of looked at Paul as a retailer of secondhand scraps, kind of the B movie of religion and philosophy, kind of picking the pieces and parts, especially the less desirable ones of other philosophies, and trying to piece together his own philosophy. So you could think of him as an itinerant peddler of religion, something that people in Athens were, of course, very familiar with because there are a lot of people who would do that. Others thought he was more of a propagandist and spreading lies of foreign gods. So you can see that it was not a environment that was very conducive to really spreading new ideas, especially ones that would make people slightly uncomfortable and have to change their ways just a bit. So just a reminder, Athens, of course, was the place that shaped the thinking of all the people in that period, not only in Athens, but in the surrounding region, for the most part, shaping how they would look at their day-to-day lives, shaping how they should live and how they should exist with the Greek gods. Of course, most of the people there had not studied philosophy, just like most people today have not studied philosophy or religion or government or anything of the liberal arts. But the philosophers shaped their thoughts of philosophy and economics, just like that happens today through either some level of education or also just through government policies or economic policies and affairs. So same sort of thing happens here, and people just kind of flow with it and kind of pick up parts as they go. As we look into verse 19, Paul was invited there, or at least requested to speak, to share his teachings with the experts at the highest court in the city, which was the court of the Areopagus, depending on how you want to say that. It pretty much exercised its jurisdiction over matters of religion and morals, and it was named after the Greek god of war, Ares. And it means the hill of Ares. Areopagus means the hill of Ares. It was high on a rock, still is to this day, where you could see the marketplace and see the Acropolis. It was not the most friendly place to come as a visitor of someone, especially with new ideas. The people there were people who liked to confront and ridicule those who had come with new ideas and beliefs. Of course, something that Paul had come with, at least to them, this divinity, this God was new. They were not familiar with this God. So to them, Paul is teaching on foreign divinities. One of those reasons is because he brings up the resurrection, which to them they think is another god. So multiple divinities. They use their own worldview to help them shape kind of what they were hearing from Paul. Good thing we don't do that anymore. Again, I've said that three times a day. We know that it was a single god, but that would not be understood by the Greeks because they were like, well, you might as well just be an atheist. Why don't you have like 100 of them or more? Because that's how it really works. anyways, they're, of course, just like we do today, take what we know in our context and how we were raised, and we apply new things that we hear to what we already know. And sometimes we will flex with it, and sometimes we won't. Paul's book of the Resurrection, which is anastasis in Greek. So to them, the people listening, like I said, anytime you use that word resurrection, many of them would be like, oh, okay, so you're talking about another god. And since anastasis in Greek is feminine, it would be to them a goddess. So the resurrected Messiah to the Athenians would be a goddess and not, of course, Jesus, who was God but and male. So for the most part, they would think of my understanding is they would think of Jesus as the male, and then the resurrected Jesus as the female consort of Jesus. So it was, of course, as you can imagine, try explaining that to these people who already think they're very intelligent, or who know they're very intelligent, because they are, and had very good philosophies that, again, like I said, we still use today. So Paul had quite a challenge in front of him, and fortunately he was really good at what he did. So in verse 18, the idea of word scatterer or babbler is, of course, full of contempt. Some would say idle babbler. Again, it depends on your translation. For the most part, they're saying you are somebody who has no sense what you're saying, and what you're saying is foolish, and it's no good for anyone. The preaching foreign divinities was the same charge that was charged against Socrates, because Socrates brought up not exactly the same claims as Paul did, but he did bring up new ideas related to the divine, and of course was ridiculed for that. So they may be interested in new ideas, but divinities from elsewhere could easily get someone in trouble, and much like it's getting Paul in trouble right here. In verse 19, the reason they could get in trouble is, first of all, it scared people, just like new ideas scare people today, or new ways of looking at things scare people today. But one thing they were very skeptical of is if someone was bringing in a secret cult or society that someone was reclaiming, would even get them in even more big trouble, because that would, of course, take over or affect negatively their own cults and their own secret societies that they had going. So they are sarcastic with Paul, asking if they were permitted to know this new idea and be part of it. So Paul's philosophy needs to either make sense to them, or he's going to be in big trouble. They were concerned Paul was dangerous to the state. So they were, of course, and the Athenians, if anyone, wanted to keep the state safe so the Romans would stay out. And so they, you know, so if Paul was dangerous to the state, they needed to stop him. So Paul at this point is actually given an opportunity of a lifetime to speak, and when his sermon it's very good, but he better bring the best A game he can possibly have. The use of new there in verse 21 is not a compliment, but a bit of sarcastic usage of words that Luke is using towards the Athenian people. These are the people who are constantly looking for the next best thing or the next best idea. The idea of new in the ancient world was one of the worst sneers one could offer regarding ideas. If it was old, that was best, and everyone knew it. So these new ideas was looked upon or looked down upon, and people would sneer at the idea of this idea of who do you think you are bringing this new idea here? But they, as you can see here, they did a lot of talking and debating about it and talking through with that. And the idea of new was novelty, even if ephemeral, when it comes to that. But here today and gone tomorrow is the way they were looking at it, without any use. But it was something many of them were focused on, because they that's all they did. All they did was talk about ideas. And so, of course, new ideas came in, and they would kind of pontificate and explain and digest and whatever related to these ideas, and they go on, and that's they thought was Paul was doing. So of course he was mocked when that happened. All right, let's go on to the actual speech itself here in verses 22 through 34. And I think what we'll do, so I think we have time for it, is that we will I'm going to go ahead and read 22 through 34, the sermon on Mars Hill, and we will go from that. Now, Paul was waiting for them in Athens. His spirit was being provoked with him in him as he was... Oh, gee whiz. That's what happens when you get distracted. Let me go back to actually verse 22, not verse 16. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the word and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said. For we are also his children. Being then the children of God, we ought not think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer, but others said, 'We shall hear you again concerning this.' So Paul went out of their midst, but some men joined him and he believed, among whom also were Dionysus the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them." Oh boy, what a speech. Many would say that this is actually just a summary. So Luke has given us a summary of Paul's speech. Could you imagine? I mean, Paul is one of those guys, he would speak for hours at a time. I mean, you got to think about the poor kid who fell out of the window falling asleep after Paul was preaching or speaking for so time. And so it could very well be the full speech. But you'd think that he was in front of everyone at this point and all these people were listening and he was had the center of their attention, he probably would have gone a little bit ever. And so either way, it's excellent what he's placed out here, and it really is a guide. But I'm just saying, based on the tradition of Greek history writing and how things were done during that time, this very well could just be a summary of his speech. Either way. One other way to look at this is possibly as a summary is that, like I said, this could only be 2 minutes if you read it in Greek. And the guy, like I said, the same guy who spoke in 4 hours. But another way to look at this is, how would we look at this? Others say it is so different that anything that he wrote in Romans, there's no way he could say it. So some people say it would be inconsistent with how he spoke and wrote in Romans, that this doesn't seem like it's even Paul at all, and probably Luke transcribing or scribe summarizing or Luke summarizing what was said. It could be. One reason that is, it kind of seems a little bit Hellenistic. So we know that Luke was a Gentile, and so he could have had kind of more of an influence there. Either way, it is a very important passage that are given to the Greeks. Here, Paul presses the buttons of the local culture for the most part. He gives a nod here or there to those that they worship, mainly to show that there are some hooks in their belief culture that would tie into what Paul was teaching. So he's trying to relate with them by bringing up their own beliefs and their own religion, which makes sense. Otherwise, you're just talking past them. And so he seems to identify some hooks that he can use, which any good teacher still does to this day. There in verse 22, when the gospel is presented to pagans, it was necessary, because that's what they were referred to back then, it was necessary to state very early that he was speaking of the one and only living true God, something that was accessible to all, yet clouded out by all the other gods and related idols. So he had to make that clear up front, otherwise they would try to add in additional gods and idols to that. Paul is giving an excellent template here to how to preach to pagans, similar to the speech given that he'd gave in Pisidian Antioch back in chapter 13. He does not go with the typical Hebrew passages, as they would not understand it. Instead, he quotes from Greek poets. Yet, it is still firm on biblical revelation from the Old Testament, if you were to really dig in to this. It still starts with God as creator and ends as God as judge. And even though he doesn't use a lot of Old Testament references, he still makes those two points, which, of course, is what we need to do. He notes here that they are very religious, or better understood today as superstitious, is actually the wording that he's using here. They're very superstitious because they have all these gods that they believe in, even the unknown gods that they seemingly believe in. And it was not allowed to compliment. So the reason we can say with understanding of what was going on during that time, so to have it with some sort of confidence here, it was, you were not allowed to go into this court and to compliment the people of the court, thinking that I'm going to get on the good side of these people if I compliment them. So instead of complimenting them, Paul refers to them as superstitious in their beliefs, and they would actually take that better than they compliment, because the compliment's like, well, what are you trying to do here? What kind of trick? What kind of game are we playing here? And so this is actually a very smart way to do that. In verse 23, he brings up the unknown God transcription, or some, like Jerome, one of the early historians and writers, fathers of the church, have translated what he said here as the gods of Asia, Europe, Africa, to unknown and foreign gods, is what the inscription said. He may have meant what we read as unknown gods, because there were times when altars had come into disrepair and were repaired, but they could not figure out who the god was who was associated with that altar, and so they put an inscription of unknown god. Mainly, it was just based on them not knowing who the god or goddess was, who the altar was originally built for, and so they would do that. So that could be one reason why he sees those and he brings that up. It is not necessarily that they are just grasping at straws, but based more on a book written about Cicero, where he writes about the academy founded by Plato, and that was a very influential group within there, and that the book, of course, that came through that was very influential as well. And according to the academic, which is what it was referred to, there's not enough evidence to tell if the gods exist or not. And if they do exist, what do they want from us? And so that's why, or one reason you would have this unknown god. So beyond just not knowing who the god was, who that maybe that altar was, they build a new altar, and they do that because of how the academic would write related to, well, we really don't have enough evidence to say if there are or there are not gods, but we better be careful here and better be safe and say there is, and let's kind of set this one up. Paul looks at this as kind of as a sense of humility and openness and readiness to something new, as in they are open to it because they are constantly searching for gods to help them. And if so, Paul is there with some good news. You can call what they are doing here open agnosticism. Agnosticism. meaning we don't seem to know at the present, but it's quite possible there is a God. We would need to, or have not quite yet discovered it. There's also the closed version of this where we don't know, we can't know, and I like it that way. And that's just the way it is. So if there could be, I don't know, we don't care. And that's fine because it makes us feel okay. Based on the idea of open agnosticism, Paul begins with questions of ignorance, which is very interesting how he does this. He also ends his speech in the same way. He wants them to think through of what God wants them to do about this ignorance. We'll see in verse 30 that the time of ignorance is over with the coming of Jesus, with the coming of the Messiah, the Jewish Messiah. They can no longer remain ignorant because it has now been revealed to the entire world, the redemption of the world and the coming of Jesus. The people who are listening there during this time are probably a bit intrigued by this Jewish faith, seeing that history is moving forward by some sort of divine power. That probably is very intriguing for them. So they are to discern what that divine goal is. Paul has to be Jewish in how he says this because he is getting to the Jewish Messiah, Jesus. So he has to be very careful with this. And he has to be careful with keeping that as there is one God and there is one Messiah. Paul knows they are open based on their idea of an unknown God to having this Jewish God. But Paul also knows that the academics mentioned above had a point related to the agnosticism of all of this. So what Paul is trying to do here, is my understanding, is way more than trying to relate with the Athenians by pointing out some of their beliefs and the window those beliefs open. He is also letting them know that judgment is coming to Athens. Athens, as in, if they believe in this God or not, judgment will be coming based on this Messiah. The gods of the Greeks or the idols created show that the Greek people are ignorant or missing the point. This also shows us that the people had a sense of divinity but were misguided in their views. They did not know what to do about what they thought they knew. And so this, of course, opens that door for Paul to be able to give this speech, is that they had a curiosity that he was there and able to fill for them. In verse 24, as we continue to move forward here, the God Paul is speaking of is living and does not live in temples made by human hands like the Greek gods require. Paul goes very Old Testament here, but in a way the Greeks would understand. Even the shrine in Jerusalem that was built could not contain the Jewish gods, certainly none of these altars built by the Greeks could hold gods. So the Greeks certainly could not hold the Jewish god, much less. Yeah, anyways. So Paul is staying amongst and above the beautiful and well-constructed temples of the Greek gods and letting them know it is not good at all. It is not good, and it all misses the point, that you have all these beautiful temples and structures and statues and idols, but at the end of the day, they're worthless. So Paul is bringing that up to them. Many knew that the divine could not be contained in physical structures, but Paul brings in here a biblical rather than a classical view of that. The God in verse 25 that Paul speaks of does not need anything brought to him by human hands, like animal sacrifices. He has come to give them what they cannot give. They cannot do what they've been wanting to do with these other gods. Only God can provide. The Jewish God does not lack any things that humans can provide, which is counter to how the pagans supply their gods with many things. Paul here is making a reference to one of the Psalms, that is Psalm 50, verses 9 through 12, where God has no need of anything because he is the owner of everything. God is the creator. God is the one who gives life and breath and everything. So we see that in 25. In verse 26, he then counters their belief that they came up from the soil, refer to themselves as indigenous type people, where they were out of the soil they come. There's a very fancy Greek word with that I cannot recall, but it has something to do with I'm not going to go there. Is this idea that they were, is kind of an ill-founded pride when compared to the truth of the creator who created all things, including humans. They thought they had come up from the soil, raised up that way, and that's of course not how it played out. Now, the whole dust and dirt and everything from Genesis 1 and 2 is different from how they thought that they were created. So the way this looks is this keeps the Greeks from seeing themselves as superior compared to everyone else who they looked at like barbarians. So the Greeks or the Athenians specifically thought they were at a higher level type of humanity than all the other people that were on the world or humans that were on the world. And so the field is being leveled at this point. So God created the entire human race and given them the entire earth as their dwelling place is probably the good point that Paul is making here. According to Genesis, the earth was created for humans before humans. And this is the original text is emphasized as the divine plan of God. And as we look into verse 27, that they would seek God if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. So showing us here that God even arranged the seasons and the time and place of humans. This was for the well-being of humans, the way that God had set everything up, so that the humans would have a desire to seek God for what he has created. They would look upon creation, nature, however you want to look at that, and see God in that and want to worship and come closer to God because of that. However, they have created false idols, when in reality they could see the true God by just looking at creation. So instead of creating all these idols and temples, they could have looked at the world around them and seen what God had created and did that. And so as we go into verse 28, Paul now illustrates his argument by quoting two Greek poets here, dealing with how God was supreme in his relation over humanity. For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his children, as we says. And both poems that he quotes, or poems, depending on what my kids like to say, Zeus is not seen as the ruler of the traditional Greek pantheon, how this is worded, but as a supreme being of Greek, especially of, say, Stoic philosophy. It seems Paul could be using the poems not to bring Zeus into the Jewish story, but to bring the Jewish God into the context of the Greeks, so they would understand, just based on what they know. This is not at all Paul saying that Zeus and God are the same thing, but helping them understand, based on their understanding of who Zeus is, about who the Jewish God is, and allowing them to see that. And it's the same for us today whenever we look at how we communicate with people and what people, the context or their worldviews, and help them see we're not diluting what we're saying, but we're helping them understand based on what they already know. Verse 29, as we continue on through this, we are the offspring of God, but not in a pantheistic way as thought of by Greeks, but more through the sense of a biblical doctrine of man being created by God in his own image. There's a lot of pantheistic tendencies nowadays. There always has been, where people want to worship objects instead of, or even mountains or trees, I guess is probably one way to look at it, or different types of animals, instead of God itself, the creator of those things. They want to worship the things themselves. And it's one thing to think that God is in those, in the stuff he's created, as in a painter is part of a painting, or a sculptor is part of the sculpture, as they put their effort and time and views and values into what they've created, but it is not them. They are still outside of those, and there's a whole other philosophical debate that you could go into related to just all the panentheism and pantheism and everything related to that, two very different things. Paul is saying that all humans were created to glorify God, and so it is our responsibility as those who are created to do so. It is a real God, not a made-up plastic God, or even a God that could be depicted through idols, is the God that we are to worship, and that is what he's telling the Greeks there at the court. Some would rationalize the pagan figures to say as like a divine homage, but most would just worship the figures themselves. So you could see where someone argues like, well, I'm not worshiping the idol itself. Though yes, I'm in front of this image and I'm worshiping, but I'm not worshiping the image. I'm worshiping the actual divine that this image represents. But at the end of the day, what was happening is that people were just actually worshiping the figures themselves, because they got the two confused. And I think we do too today in many ways. We worship our own traditions and doctrines. We worship our own church facilities, buildings. We worship the authors who become celebrities, the pastors who become celebrities. We worship them thinking that we're worshiping God. Music, we worship the music, we're not worshiping God. And that's similar to what was happening there. And so they're really not that far off from many people today whenever it comes to what are you truly worshiping. Is it something that you made, such as, or something that humans made, such as a piece of music, or a particular book, or interpretation of a book? Or is it God himself that you're worshiping? So in verse 30, we have a nice transition, as you always see transitions when you see the word therefore. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, this is a very much a transition, because what God is saying here, the Athenians up to this point could have argued that they were ignorant about the Jewish God, or the God that Paul talked of. But this ignorance is not free from blame anymore, because now they know, or they have started to hear who this God is. And Paul seems to be going beyond the speech that he gave in Lystra, going back to chapter 14, verse 6, where he allowed nations to go their own ways. We are also seeing what was said in Romans 3:25, similar sort of thing, about God's forbearance in passing over sins committed before the coming of Christ. So that was fine in the past, where God would overlook some things related to that, because people just did not know. Now that with the coming of the Messiah and the spreading of the gospel, people would know who the true God is. The thing implied here is that the coming of Christ makes a fresh start in dealings with humans, which I believe to be true as well. This idea of a new creation, a redemption of God's creation, allowing for a new creation and the combination of heaven and earth, much as what was represented in the Holy of Holies within the temple. What kind of thing that was hidden in the past is now revealed through Christ. All people must now repent of their false conception of God and embrace the knowledge of who he is through the gospel. And so all that is now coming to a head at one of the most pagan-like communities in the world at that time. So verse 31, the one who created all is also the one who will judge all of humanity, is what we'll see here. This eschatological judgment that we see here would not be something that would be easy for Greeks to understand, as it was not part of their system beliefs to think of what the end would look like in the same way that the Jews or the early Christians would think the end would look like with the coming of a Messiah. It will be Jesus the Christ who will be the judge of all, which would be a surprise to them, as he was the one who was resurrected to do that very thing. That's why Jesus was resurrected to come again. Oh, well, that's probably simplifying that a little too much, but that is what that leads to. The speech comes to an end and seems to be a great summary or introduction in Christianity to pagans. You could call it Christianity 101, a very quick quick overview. The Greeks would, at this point, we need to understand that this is not just a philosophy. They like dealing in philosophies, but this is more of a, involves moral and religious responsibilities, spiritual responsibilities beyond just a philosophy in which you pontificate about with your buddies every day there at the court. Based on what this is, based on this responsibility that now has come before them, to understand that it calls for repentance is what they are to do at this point. And the knowledge of God in the Old Testament points to the same moral order as truth, goodness, and love, and what's what he's pointing to. And what this is, at the end of the day, and because Paul is Jewish, he is providing a very Jewish viewpoint that he is giving to a Gentile crowd, but it is typical of Jewish apologists, which Paul was, to do that during this time. Defender of the faith is what he is doing. Remember, God is the Jewish God. He is the creator, which is the foundation of all good news. We must have the creator of God, or it is not good news. We must have the... How do you want to say this? We must have the redemption of God's creation, or it is not good news. If there's no redemption here, if people cannot repent and be redeemed, there is no good news. What is the point? You know it is good news because the Jewish God redeems. It's not them having to deal with a bunch of Greek gods who are squabbling as well as being a bit malevolent towards humans. It is a God that loves, a God that is truthful, and a God of wisdom and compassion and grace. verse 32, as we wrap up chapter 17. Now, when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer, but others said, "We shall hear you again concerning this." I brought this up earlier. This idea of resurrection was pretty foreign to some of these people, but was not something that, of course, they would be familiar with, and of course would not respond well to, because it is maybe one of those new ideas that is being brought to them that they do not like. The Epicureans would not have agreed with him regarding resurrections, and were probably some of the ones who ridiculed him just based on the Epicureans did not believe in resurrection, for lack of a better word. Apollo said that once a man dies, and this is coming from the Epicurean viewpoint, that once a man dies, the earth drinks up his blood and there is no resurrection. That was very much in their minds when Paul spoke of resurrection. They were very, of course, familiar with what Apollo would say. And it'd be a worldview, as you can imagine, that'd be hard for them to turn away from. Just like we have our own kind of ingrained beliefs and traditions and ideas that's hard for us to turn to whenever we start hearing truth about who God is, which is sometimes counter to what we were taught as taught over the past years, not even while growing up, because many people did not go to church growing up and are new to the faith now. So for us to always go back and say, "Oh, it's what you learned when growing up," well, it's really not. The Christian faith comes to many people at many different ages, and not just when you're 8 years old and decide to get baptized because it's some sort of emotional moment, and you feel guilty if you don't, and you want to make your parents happy. So verses 33 through 34, he now leaves the court and will eventually leave Athens, but he does have a few who will follow what he says. One is a member of the Areopagus. His name is Dionysus. We'll hear of him again. He ends up being he's actually the first bishop of Athens. And he is according to Eusebius, which I've brought up before, one of the Roman, Greek, Hellenist, let's just call him Hellenist, historians of the time. He was a leader of the church early on there in Athens. Damaris was probably a foreign woman, perhaps from the educated class of Hetarii. She could have possibly been married to Dionysus, some people have said. She is probably a bystander listening into the debate. It is not likely that she was a God-fearer, but probably just someone who was a Gentile who heard the story or heard what he was talking about. it would be odd that she was Athenian, because Athenian women did not attend courts like this. So most likely she had to be foreign. So a lot of different cultural and I guess cultural details that we cannot go into related to Athenian women and their place within the courts that time. So, all right, that's the end of chapter 17. Let's go into chapter 18, and we're going to do the first part of that. We're going to do the first 11 verses of chapter 18 and go from there. So let me read this where Paul actually leaves Athens. He heads southwest to Corinth, where he'll spend, for the most part, the next year and a half. Some people say he's there for 2 years, but it seems pretty, well, it says a year and a half here in the Bible. So, but I have seen some interesting commentaries that says 2 years. Maybe they've seen something else or have interpreted it a little bit differently. Anyways, 18, 1 through 11. Let me read that, and we will continue on Paul's journey as he travels. After these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth, and he found a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla. Because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome, he came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. But when they resisted and blasphemed, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." They left there and went to the house of a man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God, whose house was next to the synagogue. Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, believed in the Lord with all his household, and many of the Corinthians, when they heard, were believing and being baptized. And the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, "Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking, and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no man will attack you in order for you to harm you, for I have many people in this city." And he settled there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. All right, so Paul has now traveled the world, or not traveled the world, he's traveled southwest early and is now in Corinth. Corinth is another port which Paul heads down for its vast arrays of wealth, goods, and immorality. It was a wonderful city for those who were in commerce. It was not a great city for those who were not into sexual immorality. Corinth sat on an isthmus, which is allowing it to have two ports where it could literally move ships over land from one port over to the other. Now there's a canal that's built through that, but before then, they would carry the ships over land. Corinth was a political, commercial, and naval rival to Athens for many years. In 146 BC, because I know you guys like history, well, I certainly do, so bear with me. The city was destroyed by the general, a Roman general, Mummius, and then rebuilt as a Roman colony in 44 BC. It was the capital of Achaia. Some people say that Corinth was more Roman than Rome itself and is very proud of its Roman status. It did not take long for Corinth to be a major commerce hub again and became very well known for its sexual tendencies or immorality, something Paul deals with when writing to the church in Corinth. As you, if you were to read his letters that he wrote to the people in Corinth, you would see that they were dealing with a lot of sexual immorality, and he addresses that. Back in Corinth, Paul returns to the synagogues, as he likes to do, because there were several, and they are, of course, full of Jews and God-fearers. And what his pattern will be, he'll go to the synagogues first, and then from there, if they do not listen or they reject him, he'll then go to the Gentiles. Again, it's one of the major patterns that we see throughout Acts. The only part that's missing here is him getting chased out of town immediately, like what has happened in other towns that he has gone through. Fortunately, the pattern of being run out of town by angry mob does not happen to him in Corinth. We know that he stays there for a year and a half. and this is the first time since he was in Syrian Antioch where he stays anywhere for any sort of length of time. We meet two new people who we talk about a lot, Aquila and Priscilla, or Priscilla and Aquila, depending on how you read that and how you see it in other times. Sometimes she is actually mentioned before Aquila, and some people say it's because she either came from some sort of royal high standing or some sort of there was a formal reason that her name would come before Aquila. But anyways, here or there. So he meets the two. They're a Jewish couple. They ran a tent-making business. The first time in Acts, we see Paul has a trade that he does, a trade that he works on. Most likely, he was, for the most part, I think it seems like he was not really able to stay anywhere long enough to actually establish his business. But here in Corinth, he is able to do so. And tent-making is probably more thinking of people who worked in the leather goods. Paul worked on a very specific type of skin that was waterproof. It is a type of goat skin. I cannot remember the name of it at this point, but it was he kind of focused on that. And it wasn't just they weren't just making tents. They were making other things as well. It would not be abnormal for people like Paul during this time, for rabbis, teachers, to be bivocational and to have a trade such as tent making or leather working, but to also go to the synagogues and teach the law. That would not be looked upon. Actually, in Judaism, it was not considered proper for a scribe or rabbi to receive payment for their teaching. So they had to make their living somehow, and so this was how they would do it. You know, he would probably, is somebody, when he made tents, you could think of him as tents as we think of tents today. You could probably think of him as like large tarps. He it seems, based on how this plays out and the history of, we know what these leather workers or tent makers did, is they would build them, of course, for the military, for families, for commercial reasons. There could be structures for like recreation, or, you know, keeping it over, you know, a nice dinner or festival. So they were pretty busy people and had quite a demand for their goods. So it seems like Paul here is either taken on as a partner, or maybe as he obviously has already done the works, or maybe he just comes in as a day laborer for them. But anyways, he comes in and he develops a relationship with Aquila and Priscilla. We hear the two again in 1 Corinthians 16:19, as well again in Romans 16:3. They seem to travel around just as much as Paul does, between Ephesus, Corinth, and Rome. And you can imagine that people who did this sort of business would travel, going to trade shows, conferences, just finding where the need of their goods are, and would go there and to, of course, sell them. The two had left Rome for a very specific reason. Though it seems they would have preferred to stay in Rome, but they had to leave because Claudius, who was the emperor of the time, had kicked out all the Jews out of Rome at that time. And what the Roman emperors would do is that they would find the unclean, or those that they did not find desirable, and kick those people groups out periodically, just to kind of keep the Roman culture pure. And Jews or people like Aquila and Priscilla were not highly looked upon as their people group, and so they were kicked out and headed out to where we are seeing them right now. There are some historians beyond just what we see here who can verify this decree, though the dates around this are not really clear. The Roman historian Suetonius says that Claudius kicked the Jews out because they were rioting, which is probably likely. Jews at that time liked to riot, especially when people came in claiming to be the Messiah or bringing in some good news. They could be that. Most likely this based on, like I said, most likely based on somebody claiming to be the Messiah. And a Christus had arrived, and there's a lot of detail about what the Christus is. It could be being a Messiah, or it could be some sort of prophet had arrived and caused some problems. So it caused an uproar in Rome as well as in Antioch. Most likely the couple were not converts of Paul's, but believers before they made it to Rome and then after Rome. And they probably could have also been part of the Roman church that Paul writes to later on. There's another reason of how this all played out. Claudius's decree or edict is similar to other imperial edicts, as when he dies, it is no longer an edict. So his successor, Nero, came to the throne and did not have the same decree regarding the Jews, which was about 54 AD. And in this time, Priscilla and Aquila returned to Rome. It seems they have reported to Paul at one point of the issues with the Gentile church was facing when the Jews returned, which is why he could have written the letter to Rome, the one we refer to as Romans. And remember that the Gentile and Jewish church were not always on the same page and separated dramatically, probably drastically, significantly, over time. They were, sometimes very much at odds with each other. And that's probably something that Aquila and Priscilla, or Priscilla and Aquila, saw whenever they went back to Rome. And so Paul wrote that letter to help kind to quell that issue so they could move forward. Verse 4, as we continue on here, a very large commercial city like Corinth would have a large Jewish population. So, of course, they would have a local synagogue, or probably multiple local synagogues. So he was able to hold his weekly discourse every Sabbath at the synagogues, where he, of course, proclaimed the Christian message. We can wonder here, why did Paul stay so long, besides, of course, the vision of the Lord coming to him in verses 9 and 10? Some would say that Corinth was large enough to where his arguments with the synagogue Jews did not cause much of an issue, even though if they could have disagreed with him, Corinth was large enough to where he could go to another synagogue, or he could just go somewhere else and they wouldn't. They really didn't have the power or the size of the city to really do anything. It could be that many of the synagogue Jews agreed with Paul and became believers. It could be the vision from verses 9 and 10, like I said, where unlike in chapter 16, verse 9, he is told to go, he is here told to stay, and he will be okay. So you get kind of, God continues, or the Lord or Holy Spirit, however you want to look at that, continues to guide Paul through this. Here it is not a man or an angel, but seems to be God directly speaking to him there in verses 9 and 10. I know we're kind of jumping ahead. We'll come back to the other ones here in a second. There are many people in the city who need to hear the word of God. But we'll get more into that here in a second. Let's look at verse 5. Silas and Timothy have made their way down. Paul was in there for a couple of weeks or a few weeks, and Timothy and Silas drop in from Macedonia. It seems that they bring some sort of good news from Timothy regarding the work going on in Thessalonica, which is probably gave great relief to Paul. You can see that reference in 1 Thessalonians 3, 6 through 10. And then from 2 Corinthians 11 through 9, we see that a gift of money came to him from Philippi, allowing him to focus less on his tent making and more on teaching the Jewish hearers about the arrival of the promised Messiah. So some good news coming from Timothy and Silas as they make their way down from Macedonia. In verses 6 and 7, there is, of course, a lot of opposition at one of the synagogues. And eventually, Paul shook his cloak in a way that would show that he had rid himself of the dense people in the synagogue. It's probably a violent shaking of his jacket, his coat. and to show that there is none of you, none of your distaste for me or distaste for my message will remain on me as I am moving forward to go speak with the Gentiles. He seems to be more upset with their refusal to accept the Messiah and less about what they were saying about him. He was done with him at this point, and he absolved himself of any additional responsibility to tell them about the Messiah. He was now free of blame, as in he has done what he was supposed to do. They rejected him. Actually, they rejected the message, the Messiah, and so he is going on, and he is free of blame. So he finds Titus Justus's home, which was adjacent to the synagogue. Some say it probably could have been connected somehow. So those who did believe what Paul was saying would not have to go far, as in instead of going and walking to the synagogue, they would take a quick right, left, whatever, and would head into Mr. Justus's home, and they would have their own little worship service going on there. It seems like he was a God-fearing Gentile and had become persuaded by Paul. And some said that he could be the Gaius based on how his name could be translated. Based on Titus Justus's first name could have been Gaius. It's really weird the way Roman names would work. Many times they had three names. Sometimes only went by the second two. The Gaius could have been what they refer to as praenomen, which is his first personal name given by the parents. So he could have been Gaius Titus Justus. Anyways, I don't think that's a stretch, but it is someone who is referenced in 1 Corinthians 1:14, who is one of the few converts in Corinth who Paul baptizes. He would be the one who would seemingly house the early church in Corinth, and based on the amount of people that he was able to fit into his house, he seemed to be a person of means, so he had a large home for people to gather in. That's a little bit of history there. Verse 8, Crispus here, who's the leader of the synagogue, decides to be baptized and become a believer. You could imagine that was quite controversial as the leader of the synagogue. It doesn't say that he's a priest. There's probably a little bit more we probably could have dug into that to see exactly what that means. And if I would have had more time to look at that one specifically, he could have just been an official of the synagogue. It's really kind of, it's not difficult, but it was something that wasn't clear. It didn't seem like he was a priest, I guess, is where I'm getting with that. So he takes off. He becomes a believer. Many others do the same, which probably helped Paul's time there to be a bit easier, a bit less violent towards him, because they had Crispus, who, even though he had kind of left the synagogue, he probably had a lot of pull and could convince people not to go beat up on Paul. So he and his family walk across the street to Gaius's house to join the new Christian community. We get the vision here in verse 9 and 10. After leaving the synagogue, Paul gets a good vision that will, of course, shape the future that he will have there in Corinth. The Messiah appears to him and assures him no harm will come upon him. Though he was violently removed out of Thessalonica and Berea, I mean, he wasn't like beaten up or anything, but it was a violent situation in which he had to move quickly, or he would have been. It will not be the same for him in Corinth. The Messiah, he understands the message that he should go forward boldly. He knows that through what Jesus is telling him there, that he should go forward and do his work. I would say this is, of course, a vision of encouragement for Paul. Was probably very much needed by Paul after being beat up pretty well in the synagogue again, having more people come up against him. He was probably packing up when he had the vision. He was like, I'm tired of this. I'm done. We're moving forward on to wherever the wind takes me, or the Spirit. He knew he had to eventually get to Rome, and he was used to traveling, so he may have thought it was time to move on again based on some of the what was going on and how things were playing out. We learn in Acts that we get guidance when we most need it, and we're most likely not looking for it. And that's what happened for Paul. It happens to us too if our eyes and hearts and ears are open to God working around us. It's not always a lot of detail, or even to us enough detail, but you have to always remember that it is sufficient what God provides. All right, last verse that we're talking about today, he settles there. for a year and a half. The next 5 years of his ministry will be less about traveling, but more about inaugurating new churches and consolidating the Christian believers in the two centers on the west, east and the west of the Aegean. And first he's in Corinth and then off to Ephesus, and he'll travel back and forth between those as well as some other places. But that'll be kind of his focus for the next 5 years. All right, so we're wrapping up for today. Actually, we just wrapped up. Next time, we're going to do verses 12, start at chapter 18, verse 12. Oops. And continue to make our way and through 12, finish up 12, going to 19, probably part of the way into 19, maybe 19:10, depending on how well it gets. Actually, that looks like probably what we'll do. So anyways, thank you. Have a great week.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.